Good morning, Andy. How are you?
Hey Andy, how are you doing? Sorry, I was a bit late.
Not at all. Very important day. Happy birthday, Dot. Hopefully, you've got some nice things planned in the sunshine. Are you having an almighty bash tonight, or what are you up to?
No, we're just going to go and see some play at the new Diorama Theatre.
Interesting house. I think I've been there a couple of times. Is that the one up near on the Euston Road? Yeah.
I don't know what it is, some kind of futuristic dystopian thing, maybe. We'll see how it goes. I mean, she's actually dots out with a sister and who's come down from Scotland and various friends at the moment, so
Yeah, there's a whole womanly aspect to this, isn't it? Which means that we are consigned somewhat to the shade, I suppose.
yes. Well, that's all
This.
right. I mean, I'm quite happy in the theoretical shed. How are you?
Actually, not too bad. It's been the hard yards for a few weeks with an unfortunate situation with the previous employer, but that may resolve on Monday, and I think I've got a new post to go to.
Yeah, that's
So.
what I saw you post
Oh,
about it.
thank you very much. Yeah. Completely out of the blue. It's just one of those rather like our conversations where we seem to be on the same page with this, me and this organization, the way that we are. So hopefully that's going to work out okay.
Right, okay.
Yeah. But interestingly, if you think back to the anniversary of the Good Life, there's now a street population in Surbiton. You know, that's me.
Okay.
I don't know if Margot and a Yellow Wellies is among that number there, but Margot and Jerry, but who can say? I shall find out.
Cool.
Anyway, thanks. I wonder if we could start talking dystopia about the situation with Mohamed Khalil
Oh,
and the,
yes.
well, is it Romeo Ostrayer, who's also, I think, incarcerated?
Yes. Shall I start talking?
Would you like to?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you raise the case of Mahmoud Khalil there, Andy, because I've been following the story, but I just came up across the latest decision that was taken by an immigration judge today, which is just so deeply shocking. For background, if people don't know, Mahmoud Khalil is a Syrian-born Palestinian scholar in the United States. So he's a legal US resident. And he'd been involved as one of the main organizers of the pro-Palestine protests at Columbia University in New York. A month ago, more or less, he was just suddenly abducted by immigration agents when he was with his wife, who is shortly to give birth to their first child and who is, I believe, a US citizen. Just abducted, I mean, pl plainly just kidnapped, essentially, taken 1,000 miles to a detention facility in Louisiana run by ICE, the immigration authorities. So he's there with a whole load of other people whose crime is that they've tried to get into the United States and the United States doesn't want them and is now trying to get rid of them again. He has never been charged with a crime, and it turns out that the position that the government is taking is not that he engaged in any acts that are illegal. It's not that he engaged in speech that was illegal, which of course is a huge First Amendment issue. It's even worse than that. They are seeking to deport him because they don't like the way that he thinks. It's thought crime. And if what you think isn't protected by the First Amendment, along with free speech, then we're in deeply, deeply alarming territory. Now, I have to say that the decision that was taken to allow him to be deported was taken by an immigration judge. The immigration judge isn't dealing with the constitutional issues that are involved in whether or not the government of the United States can completely erase the First Amendment and decide to deport people because they think that what they think doesn't align with US foreign policy interests. And that's really what they're saying is that
Or endangers them in some way. Or I think endangers them in some way. Is that the phrase?
Yeah, I mean it's a part of some legislation that, you know, there, I mean, obviously the Trump administration has had some very devious people going through every bit of legislation they can find for things that they can pick on.
Sort of McCarthy era, isn't it, in terms of origin, point of origin.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean it's, you know, it's going to get challenged. I would be surprised if it stands you know, repeated legal challenges. But the very premise that that the United States is saying, we can deport anyone who's a legal resident here, if we don't like what they think, let alone that we don't want any more to give them the protected right under the First Amendment to say what they want, which is such a cornerstone of what the Americans themselves cherish as freedom of speech, and you know, and actually is quite enormously significant. I mean, you know, one of the crucial things that differentiates the societies that we live in from societies that are much more openly disdainful of the rights of individuals is that we do have the right. We have certain rights of freedom of speech that, you know, that don't exist in authoritarian regimes where you're not allowed to criticize the government. The weird situation that we've ended up in now is that had Mahmoud Khalil been openly criticizing the United States government, he would have been perfectly allowed to do so, because the United States now has become a country that protects the rights of Israel and not the rights of the United States. So, you know, I would say the Trump administration is demonstrating that it's now owned by Israel. It's astonishing.
There are legal challenges. Do you feel that other nations connected to America, or indeed disconnected to America, will be feel obliged in some way to catch cold from this particular fever?
Yeah, there's a fear that that the contagion could spread. So I don't know whether you've seen or heard, but Germany is intending to deport, I think, four individuals. I think two of them are Irish, for the
Are they?
crime of having been critical of Israel. I mean, obviously it will spread if it's not stopped. I mean, I think the biggest damage that the United States is doing is to itself, obviously, because if you were, you know, any kind of talented and interesting student who wanted to go and study in another country, and who was, you know, in the situation that we're in now. Had the temerity to oppose a genocide that's being undertaken by this ally of the West in the Middle East. And if you had the temerity to support the right of civilians in the Gaza Strip not to be murdered indiscriminately every hour of the day, why would you go to America? I mean, you know, I would imagine that that they're going to lose a vast number of foreign students.
There's a quite,
And
yes, isn't it?
actually, I mean, I saw some figures the other day from one of the, you know, the handful of US elected representatives who's opposing this vocally, who was producing quite eye-wateringly high figures of how much money comes into the United States from foreign students. And I'd say, you know, they must be doing a very good job of wiping this out completely.
It saved British universities a number of years ago, didn't it? And I suppose might have to again. I think there are some 1.5 million students in the US at the moment who are going to have their social media posts examined.
Yeah, I mean, that's astonishing. And I'm presuming that as well, you know, what that demonstrates, Andy, is that they've got this is one of the uses of AI, that they've got programs that can just scour everything that anyone has written or posted. I mean, that's horrendous as well. I mean, it's horrendous. It's horrendous on so many levels because of the First Amendment rights, and because what they're specifically doing is targeting what they're calling anti-Semitism, which of course the State of Israel has spent such a long time insisting that criticism of the state of Israel for whatever it does, up to and including a monstrous genocidal assault on Gaza, is anti-Semitism. I mean, it's made the term completely meaningless.
We do have this open letter, don't we, to the Israeli Defense Secretary from some reservists. I gather largely retired, and some academics have joined them, saying that they really want an end to all this.
Yes, and actually, what's also happened, Andy, is that nearly 1,000 Air Force reservists. So these are not retired people; these are people that are expected by Israel to
show up
engage
and do the duty,
actively in the ongoing assault on the Gaza Strip, have said that then they're unwilling to continue anymore. Not they don't have concerns for the Palestinians. Per se. In fact, you know, I mean, that's the problem, is that liberalism within Israel still doesn't really care about the value of Palestinians' lives. But they don't believe that the war has any purpose anymore, and they believe that its only purpose is there's no military aim. This is political. This is to prop Netanyahu up. And as far as I understand it, Andy, they've all been dismissed. Nearly 1,000 people. And then the last story that I saw yesterday was that 150 people in the naval branch of the Israeli military have also done the same thing. So something is turning within Israel, which has to be a good thing, because it's quite possible that the only way for these horrors to be brought to an end is within Israel itself. I think what we've unfortunately seen far too clearly since Donald Trump got in, after the initial, what looked initially to be very positive, that he, you know, he came into office as the ceasefire took effect. But, you know, almost since then, everything that he's done has been so appalling. And I think the key phrase is open the gates of hell, which he has uttered, and which the Israelis are also using. In this whole fake narrative they've constructed that Hamas is obstructing the release of the hostages, and therefore they need to open the gates of hell on Gaza and, you know, and give it even more punishment than it's had over 18 months, which is just horrendous. And
largely attacking women and children.
Yeah, absolutely.
A newborn had its arm blown off yesterday, I think.
Oh, I know. It's just it's more horrendous than it's ever been, Andy, isn't it? I mean, you know, 18 months of this was, you know, you think you've reached a place in the depths of human experience where it can't get worse, and actually, I think it's worse, because they, you know, they're starving them to death as well. They're deliberately destroying the water supplies. No medical supplies are getting in. It's on every level. What's happening is an attempt to exterminate the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip while pretending that there is this option that they can leave. I mean, they're trapped.
Yeah.
You know, if you were to take an analogy, which I think is a useful analogy, and particularly kind of significant in terms of what's happened in the world over the last 10 years. When the fighting in Syria was so intense 10 years ago, there was a huge refugee exodus from Syria, you know, into the neighboring countries and into
and
Europe.
Further afield, yes. Yeah.
Which was, you know, which was the first thing that triggered the rise of the far right in Europe, because the number of Syrians that were coming into Europe suddenly made immigration this huge issue. I think it led to the Brexit vote. I think if there hadn't been a huge influx of Syrian refugees, it might not even have happened, but it came quite soon afterwards.
Domino theory.
But, you know, the great irony of that is that, of course, compared to Gaza, the reason the Syrians were able to flee was because they're not trapped in a prison. You know, Gaza is literally besieged. The people cannot leave Gaza at all without the permission of the Israelis. And they're parading this notion to the world of the voluntary migration of people, because, you know, the only other option is death by various means. But they're not even facilitating that. The Rafah crossing to Egypt remains closed. They closed it on March the 18th when they resumed the bombing. No one is getting out of Israel, even though they're claiming that's what they want.
Israel has been clipping the edges of Syria, hasn't it? Stating that it wants to address what it feels are hostile vestigial military installations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they seem to, they're engaged in war in Syria, they're engaged in war in Lebanon, they're engaged in war with Yemen, with full Western support. They want Iran. I mean, the only thing this week is that Netanyahu went to the White House and he didn't get that because, the mercurial figure of Trump has decided that he wants to talk to Iran. What Netanyahu wants more than anything is war with Iran.
That's potentially the next big thing, is it? And what do you feel is the likely outcome of the dialogue that the US is having with the Iranians?
I'm really hoping that obviously I'm hoping that this doesn't go ahead, Andy, because I think there are people within the United States establishment, if you like. So, what's happened since Trump got in is that he's basically like pouring acid, liberally spraying acid throughout the whole of the US establishment and dissolving components of the administrative processes of how everything
I
works.
think his own legal department, funnily enough. But
But I think that there are people within the military with experience, so certainly not the defense secretary, who had a minor role before he became involved in right-wing media, and has no leadership experience or knowledge. But I think that there are people within the military in the United States who are very wary of embarking on something that will lead to large numbers of US troops having to be engaged in combat somewhere, and potentially huge losses of life. I think that that's a significant part of the machinery of how the US military operates. I think they're very wary, having gone through the experiences of Afghanistan and Iraq, are willingly embarking on some other suicidal mission. So, I mean, I hope that's the case.
There is this Trump trope of brinkmanship, isn't it? As with the tariffs and the fact that the passive aggression of them has caused seismic impact, some allegedly sustainable losses among the oligarchs or the broligarchs.
yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting in a way that he's come up against something that he can't control, which is the markets. I mean, people like to pretend that are within the financial sector that there's some kind of science. It seems to me that it's just a very emotion-based thing. And if somebody does something and freaks out people within the machinery of money, then they're going to get clobbered. I mean, we saw it very spectacularly in the UK with Liz Truss. And what we've seen with Donald Trump is that he's clearly is regarded as having crossed a line into punitive idiocy, essentially, which has spooked the markets. And I think, despite the fact that he's pulled back a bit, I think he may have done lasting damage to the credibility of the United States as a safe pair of hands, which will last until he's gone.
Interesting. Just by sheer coincidence, no doubt. Sorry to interrupt you. There's a bunch of aforementioned oligarchs. A guy called Charles Schwab, who made, I think, 2.5 billion or something as the stock market plummeted and went up again.
Oh,
But just the one.
the insider trading. I mean, there's a clip of something that somebody recorded in the White House of Trump
That's the
pointing to a
one.
couple of guys and saying he made $1 billion and he made 900 million.
As it were, as a justification or proof of the efficacy of what he's doing, through the trickle down.
Well, I mean, I think it's just gangster behavior, isn't it? I mean, it's like literally a handful of people in the room with him are making money out of causing devastation to the United States economy and causing huge consternation and unease throughout the entire global economy, all because of one man. And all it now seems that, you know, that a sideline of that was that some of his mates made a lot of money betting on it. I mean, it's a kind of outrageous, isn't it?
It is. Well, there was this guy called Crispin O'Dell, wasn't there, a little while ago in the Truss era. I think your analogy is exactly on point there, Andy. Yeah. Meanwhile, in the UK, as we speak, the UK Parliament is meeting to debate the idea of nationalising British Steel, which apparently is Chinese-owned, is losing £700,000 a day. I remember when my father was an engineering draftsman, the company he worked for was taken over some 6 times in as many years. It just shunted across Scandinavia, went to America, went to Russia briefly, you know, all sorts of places. So we haven't advanced very far. And the argument seems to be that this is going to be important for the defence industry under the Ukrainian pretext. What do you make of all that?
Well, I'm laughing bitterly there because it's being framed in a military context, because that appears to be one of the few drivers of the Starmer government. Unbridled support for Israeli war crimes, unbridled enthusiasm for war in Ukraine, unbridled enthusiasm for impoverishing the rest of an already damaged economy to support these things. It's appalling. Everything that he says about increasing weapons manufacturing and how it will benefit people in every high street, and it's like, what nonsense is this? I think the saddest part of this story, obviously, Andy, is how we ended up deindustrializing ourselves, you know, from Thatcher onwards, to such an extent that we can't make steel on any economically viable basis in this country. I mean, that's just ridiculous. I mean, it's just one of the many things of the deindustrialization of Britain under Thatcher that I think has had such a baleful effect for such a long time. Yeah. You know, I mean, coal is an emotional issue, but I mean, it turns out that after the miners' strike and looking at the environmental impacts of coal, you know, coal is not a viable product for the future of humanity on this planet. Making steel, however, is something that is a kind of crucial to various aspects of the way that we live. And, you know, the fact that we don't have any and can't keep a business viable, it's a bit of a condemnation, I think, of the failures of 40 years of neoliberalism.
So how do you walk back from all that? I mean, is it possible to be in favour of some kind of an intervention in the state that things are in?
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, I don't know how much money this is going to cost. I mean, if you're That's putting yourself in a position...
500 million for starters, I think.
Where you're just hemorrhaging money to support something because the system of sustaining it somehow doesn't work. I don't know. I mean, you know, it would seem to me that the problem is that what's not being prioritized, and I suppose we're getting into Trumpian territory here, where Trump wants things manufactured in America for the benefit of America. That's one aspect of the story. I mean, he completely fails to understand how international trade is and how, you know, 99% of everything that is consumed by the Americans isn't made in America, and that you can't change that overnight by clicking your fingers, and you certainly can't change it without you know, eye-watering amounts of investment. Britain, it seems to me, is probably in the worst position of all the countries in the West, because we're not this, you know, towering economy, and we have literally stripped everything from ourselves over 40 years. So if you're going to make steel in the UK, you'd think that the market for it, the primary market for it, ought to be the UK. But it's not as though we have a political system that will encourage that. It's like, well, no, because you'll still be buying steel from somewhere else, and then you'll undermine your own investment in the British steel industry. It seems to me that's the problem. I mean, one of the fanciful notions with Brexit, I think, Andy, was that it would bring everything back to Britain, and that we would become more self-sufficient and more self-reliant. And the problem is that because we're run by criminals at every level who are profoundly unpatriotic, I would say, it's all about the bottom line. It's all about their short-term gains. And investing in something is just not regarded as worthwhile at all. I mean, this is a country of asset stripping rather than investment.
Somebody pointed out, I think the other day, that was it Richard Murphy, that Scunthorpe, where this particular Target Steelworks is prime Reform UK territory. So there's also a political imperative for Labour to get in there quick, I suppose, really. It also occurs to me that we're now striking deals not only with China but with the UAE and various other sometimes questionable regimes, pretty much on Brexit lines. And this has been accelerated, really, hasn't it? But there's not particular European dimension to interventions like this, which I suspect there might usefully have been.
Yeah, I think that we're constantly seeing the problems of having cut ourselves adrift from the EU, which is that I can see it infecting the Starmer government as well. They're not part of a larger decision-making process anymore. Britain, we cut ourselves off from everything. We don't have to pay attention to the checks and balances that in many ways the EU tries to do amongst itself. If you imagine that, you've got several dozen people in a room from all the countries in the EU, and that somebody says, "Oh, I think we should do this," then there will be other people going, "No, I'm not sure that that's a good idea, actually." We are literally in a room on our own, with no checks and balances on what people think about what Britain should be, what Britain can be. And with now like nearly a decade of people lying about any positive aspect of what it means, because there hasn't been any positive aspect of what it means. But it's encouraged our leaders to think that there are no restraints. And Labour is the elephant in the room for Labour is that they refuse to engage, to contemplate closer ties with the EU in any meaningful way, which is what we actually need. So they're constantly chasing, they're unable to do anything. They're losing to the far right, who opportunistically somehow are managing to persuade people that Nigel Farage would be a safe pair of hands for anything other than just, rampant corruption. And they're chasing that vote. So they're chasing further and further to the right. When they'll never actually manage to convince people that's their genuine territory, because they're supposed to be something else. They've betrayed what they are supposed to be almost entirely. So if you're on the left, there's nothing of the left left in Labour. But if you're not, you st then people on the right will still look at Labour as dangerous socialists. Stand up for something. And stand up for something that's on the left, because we so desperately need it.
Interesting to see the Greens are doing quite well in North London, the albeit a council level this past couple of days, as well as Reform. Also noticing a letter, as you might expect, from Jeremy Corbyn to Liz Kendall about the cuts to personal independence payments. So those people who've been in industry and it's incapacitated them, from the vestiges of poor monitoring of health and safety or whatever. With these things in play, where do you think the left stands in relation to issues like this? And again, something like a steelworks, which would have been its traditional territory.
Well, I mean, I just the problem that not we don't only have this problem here. This problem is very noticeable in the United States. There isn't a left. You either get a warmongering neoliberal centrist party, or you get an even more warmongering neoliberal right-wing or far-right party. The left has been marginalized so much and erased so much, and it clearly bears no relationship to what people themselves think. A massive number of people in all Western countries support broadly what we, you know, what we would call aspects of socialism, but we're not represented in the slightest. So our hope is when, you know, of course the Greens are going to make gains. Anywhere that there are people who are intellectually analyzing the state of the world are going to say we need people who can address the problems that we're facing, the problems caused by rampant and ever-increasing inequality, the problems caused by refusing to take on board the challenge of catastrophic climate collapse, and you know the opportunities that for how we can change our economic model, but also invest in mitigating it, which you know which cr would create work. I mean, just different ways of thinking about things that are just not represented at all. If we had proportional representation, I think that would obviously help to some extent to empower, I think, to empower the left. Obviously, if we were to look at it now and we had the next general election and we had proportional representation, then it looks like reform would, you know, would get a vast number of seats. But in the longer run, we just can't seem to empower the voices that we need under the existing system of first past the post system.
So, are you implying then that we'd have to grasp the nettle and deal with reform for as long as they're effective, which some people might estimate as being as far ahead as 20 minutes, and then
Yeah.
have another election? Something along those lines.
I don't know what to think, Andy. I mean, you know, it's very hard to get beyond the kind of sinking feeling that people in significant numbers would take seriously a kind of pale echo of Donald Trump, of you know, of a figure that apparently is a populist who somehow manages to promise people that things will get better under them, even though any kind of analysis shows that that's simply untrue. It's simply untrue that there's no way that Nigel Farage would deliver anything of any benefit to anybody apart from Nigel Farage himself and his mates.
There's a trope in what you're saying that I think really rings true in America, insofar as I have my vicarious knowledge of the place, is that there is this concept of remoteness from the seat of government, and they're all in it for themselves, which you would probably get in, I don't know, the back end of Albuquerque, or we call it in sort of like Thanet, which is far enough away from Westminster to feel like a world away in terms of the investment in the place. It's a, it, there are almost there are two Englands now, aren't there, really, in the way that there are two Americas.
And then the problem is that people believe the snake oil salesman. So, you know, I would be surprised if there's anywhere in the country that is less represented by its MP than Clacton, where Nigel Farage is the MP, where he clearly, you know, he's not interested. It's a stepping stone. He doesn't actually have sympathy with the people that he claims to represent. He has even less sympathy with the people that he claims to represent than a lot of people from the existing parties. And yet here he is, you know, doing an imitation of Trumpian populism to appeal to people who are desperate for some kind of change, but cannot see that the person who's offering it to them is a liar and a charlatan.
It's curious how the one playbook imitates the other. Maybe not so curious in that they know the fact that these playbooks exist and are now universally available.
Well, and also because they're, you know, manipulating people through social media to quite a huge extent. You know, they're pumping out their message relentlessly to people. Yeah, I just I hope that there will be a waking moment for people, and you know, things are going to change so much, Andy, that we can't really imagine them. You know, there is no great economic revival going to happen because we're on a planet that we're killing, and the cost of that is going to become bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, I don't know whether you know, it wasn't even front page news, but you know, a very senior figure within the insurance industry just last week said, you know, climate change is going to destroy capitalism, because they're actually at the front line of capitalism's money making opportunities, because you can't insure things that are uninsurable. And basically, he was saying more and more and more and more and more of everything is going to become uninsurable, and then that will just lead to system collapse. This is like the CEO of one of the major insurance companies, and yet, you know, no, it's in the news for 10 minutes and then it drifts off again. So, you know, that was, to me, has been the most farcical thing about the Labour government since they got in and started, you know, coming up with the emptiest sound bites about growth for Britain. What were they talking about? They've never been talking about anything that has any substance to it whatsoever. Talking about creating jobs. People have been saying this for decades now, politicians, and they've all been lying. The reality is that they do not create more jobs of value, because, you know, there's no manufacturing sector for there to be those jobs in. We've got a precariat, we've got 0 hours contracts, we've got people who are endlessly kept in a state of precarity, and it's deliberate. It's part of the system, and politicians have to claim that they're doing something, whether they're Labour or they're Conservative. They have to claim that they're doing
The
something about it,
optics, isn't
but
it?
they
It's
never
often.
actually do anything about it. And you know, I came across a, I can never remember who it was. I've looked for the quote since and I haven't been able to find it. It was a philosopher talking about neoliberalism and saying the intention of neoliberalism is to keep as many people as possible, as nervous as possible, as much of the time as possible. That's what we are. We are cogs in a machine that is about creating profit for a handful of people, by screwing us up as much as possible and disempowering us and paying us as little as possible. And
The curious bit of aspect of that is that we therefore consume less, which you would have thought would feed the machine rather
well,
less
yeah, they've never
adequately.
really understood that, have they? That, I mean, that's happening across society. I mean, you can certainly see it in Britain now. The cost of everything is so much that no one can even afford to even pay for the basics. And yet we're still supposed to be primed to be consumers, but the system that is encouraging us to be consumers is stripping out our ability to be consumers to such an extent that ever increasing numbers of people have literally got no disposable income. None.
Having paid for the basics when they can, indeed.
Yeah.
Strange paradox of what Starmer is adamant he doesn't want to call managed decline, but in your description, your liquid description, does begin to feel like it.
Yes.
Andy, can I ask you to put your erstwhile bicycling around London hat on? A couple of days ago, I had the privilege of meeting a woman called Thelma Fry, who's just turned 100. She's a former actress of some renown. She's in Coronation Street, appeared with all. Orson Welles, all kinds of people in a day. She's now saying that if the Wimbledon Tennis Association, Royal Tennis Association, proceeds with its planned development, she will chain herself to one of the trees. She raced me up the stairs successfully to look at this extraordinary view, Capability Brown view. You'll be familiar with it. You'll probably also be familiar with the fact that there's a judicial review happening in early July. The Lawn Tennis Association's case is that Wimbledon will not be a viable for global television unless it gets 38 practice courts and effectively concretes over most of the park, which it more or less owns now, but for one or two people who've held on there with little huts and things. What do you make of that? There's some 50 cases waiting in the wings across London of greenbelt land that is looking to be similarly redeployed. What do you make of all that?
Well, it comes down to a few factors, really. The ones that immediately spring to mind when you were discussing it is that, on the one hand, there is the vast corporate wealth and power of the global entertainment industry, of which sports is a part, and Wimbledon is a a key part in the global calendar. On the other hand, what you've got is an area in London with people who constitute part of the establishment, and so who have the most power when it comes to resisting change being imposed on them, which is destructive. I mean, if you were to if you compare this to Tottenham, for example, Andy, what happened in Tottenham is that for absolutely no benefit to the local community in one of the poorest areas in London, a space age Colosseum that costs more money than anyone can
Spurs
imagine
FC,
was built there to house Tottenham Hotspur Football Club. That is the equivalent of what they're proposing in Wimbledon is a massive expansion that is brutal and environmentally destructive, but they're doing it in somewhere that is beautiful, that has history, and that has people who are not persistently sidelined in the way that the working class population of Tottenham are sidelined.
which I suppose you could
The
argue is beautiful in the sense of diversity, but not in terms of
well-off
its
people of the
architecture.
leafy suburbs of Wimbledon have more of a voice.
That's what it comes down to. How do you see it panning out? Because it's an audacious move to spend this amount of money and to make the business case for something that appears to be fleeting. I mean, in terms of the annual sporting calendar, no doubt they find other uses for it. But it seemed, at a practical level, it doesn't seem to fit the site.
I presume that what we're talking about here, Andy, really is that would then generate, hundreds of millions of pounds more, through expanding what Wimbledon is. Making it bigger means that there's more money, which means that there's more profits for the handful of people who are profiting out of it. I mean, that's all it is, isn't it?
So
No
it.
one cares about the bigger picture if somebody's going like, I don't really want to tell you this publicly, but I am going to trouser a vast amount of money through this thing happening.
So effectively, then culturally, we're looking at old money and new money, aren't we? The sort of argument that recurred all those years ago in the 80s, it all still seems like 20 minutes ago to me and the view as well. But we, in that sense, we haven't come very far. But there are still these voices that say, "Up with this, down with this sort of thing," which the Buffett and Tufton aspect of this. But we also have to square this, I suppose, and broadly speaking, with the overall alleged ambition to build affordable housing, which this clearly is not, and that the whole idea of planning regulation and deregulation.
Well, I mean, that entire thing is just still horrendously broken, isn't it, Andy? If we're going to get into housing, But again, I mean, this is a government of no change. They have no boldness on housing issues. It's funny because I wanted to follow up on when you were talking about
Oh, please do.
the attack on disability benefits earlier. I mean, this, if you look back on the history of governments that have pledged a war on the most vulnerable people in society, the most vulnerable,
The scoundrels.
the disabled, the
So
long-term
to speak.
disabled people. We have one of the least generous welfare systems in the world, one of the least generous, and yet every government going back as long as we can remember, the 90s, the noughties, the 2010s, it doesn't matter whether it's Labour or Conservative, at some point they declare a war on the disabled. And what we've seen, every other time before is that these have been seen off, through quite vigorous campaigning quite often, and through certain amounts of high level dissent. It's another sign of the unimaginable lack of vision of this government that they too have just gone like, oh, the memo's just arrived. It's time to wage war on the disabled now.
It's almost it's the third act sort of thing. It's like a
Yeah, I
definable
mean,
moment, isn't it?
it's unbearably cruel, and particularly now, I think, now that I think that it is harder for people without money, much money, to live in Britain than it has been at any other time in my life. And to be just targeting the vulnerable, especially as there is a, a growing crescendo of people saying, I don't know how you're going to do it, and I don't want you pretending that you can't. You have to go after the people who've actually got the money and get them to give some of it up. And I mean, I've been having interesting conversations recently, Andy, about wealth taxes, because of course, usually it's defeated by people going, yeah, but they'll just get round it. They'll just go somewhere else, or they've got clever lawyers. It's like, no, you shouldn't defeat the argument before you've attempted to implement it. It does seem to me that the responsible way forward now would be for transnational cooperation to suppress tax evasion and tax avoidance, which would also have to involve shutting down tax loopholes and tax havens. But we're all facing it. Every country in the West is facing a problem that we are skint, essentially, that the amount of money that we need to maintain an even barely adequate level of standard of living for all of our people is being crushed every year, being crushed more and more and more and more, because the oligarchs don't pay any money into anything. And it's unsustainable. If people believe that that's the only way forward, they're basically echoing what the Labour government is doing, which is that before they got in, they campaigned on saying nothing about anything because they didn't have anything to say about anything. When they got in, they've done nothing because they have nothing to say about anything, because they won't confront the notion that you can't keep saying there's no money when you're refusing to tap the source of all the money. It's that simple.
I wonder what your reaction is to the word philanthropy. I say this because some years ago, I finished the tune when I was living in North London, sat on the night bus. Oddly enough, somebody had deposited a copy of the Archant Mayfair Times, which was devoted to, I think, young Asian.com billionaires trying to figure out where they could help. Dimly noticing, not dimly sense of intellect, just in terms of the political fog, the problems that were adjacent to where they were, but nearly not having a clue as to where to make an intervention. They're big into it in America, aren't they? I don't know if they still will be, or indeed how much money will be available after the stock market crashes.
Well, there's all kinds of things going on. I mean, there's a lot of philanthropic, organizations that have been set up and have been running for a long time. There's also, the whole topic of high wealth individuals who engage in philanthropic work. And of course, some of them do it very noticeably, and some of them are the absolute opposite. So they never publicize what they do. It's very hard to read an overall picture of who's doing what. I think what we can be clear about is that, shall we say, the kind of the new tech overlords of our world are people who are, I would suspect, the least likely to pay anybody anything under any circumstances.
Unless
They
it's
don't
maybe
want to
to buy
pay
some
tax.
votes,
I very much doubt that they give a penny away to any philanthropic or charitable organization either. It's pure 100% greed. So, I mean, I find it interesting. There are the billionaires. You must have come across them. There's a few movements of billionaires who are begging governments to tax them more. Abigail Disney is one. But there's a few people that are quite vocal about the need for them to be taxed more. And I'm presuming that what some of these people are doing is they're engaging in philanthropy, which is, absolutely fine. I don't think there's ever any excuse for people who have too much for them not to engage in philanthropy. It's a win-win. Do it. But don't let governments off the hook for saying that the job of government should be to pursue people with vast amounts of wealth to enable us to run functioning societies. I mean, did we learn? We obviously learned nothing from history, Andy. We grew up at the end of hundreds of years of brave people who often lost their lives chipping away at the right of the people who said that they were above us all, that they were ordained by God, that they had the right to make it, to control everybody and to control everything, chipping and chipping and chipping away at it, so that so that we ended up not up a chimney when we were 10 years old, so that we ended up not working 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, unable to afford anything. People don't give this stuff away willingly. And what we've had for the last 40 years is a complete rollback of any responsibility from politicians, or really from the mainstream media, to suggest that that this is a one-way ticket to an ever-declining society in all of our countries if we refuse to tackle the unbridled power of the super rich.
Well, I think that what you're saying comes across to me very vividly, for example, in terms of the virtual collapse of the US aid effort, which was a global enterprise of humongous proportions. Curiously enough, spearheaded amongst other people by George Bush Jr. with regard to HIV and so forth. But we now have a huge humanitarian display in Darfur, for example, and really no resources out there that can safely address it. So someone's going to have to step up to the plate here. Bill Gates talks about it.
Well, I mean, it would seem to me that it's probably more likely that China will do things, because China isn't interested in engaging in war. They're interested in going to places and going, well, look, we've got some money here, and you've got things that we need. Let's trade on that basis. I mean, the whole USAID. I mean, it's quite weird actually, Andy, because the USAID was, I think, objectively. An objective analysis would suggest that part of the entire US aid operation for a very long time has been about reinforcing the United States' message about itself, about propping up certain regimes and destabilizing others. This is, if you look at what's coming out of the left, or what we might call the far left, there's no sorrow at all about Donald Trump cutting down US aid. Then you look at the other side of the picture, which is the vast amounts of money that America was putting into vulnerable people and places around the world, combating the spread of diseases. I mean, all of these things, which are, if those aren't positive, then where are we? Where are we? Obviously there's a question there about what is it being financed by? I mean, at some level, what Trump's saying is, I've been talking to the people that I claim are intelligent about the
Good
economy, and it
authority.
seems to be the United States is burdened with a colossal amount of debt, and we're spending money that we don't have in all kinds of places. And that's a conversation that's going to go on, because I think it's quite pivotal to what's happening, is that he is trying to pretend, in the same way that Rachel Reeves is doing here, in a very kind of parochial, tiny manner, going like, we haven't got the money. We haven't got actually got I've got a tin here, and it hasn't got any savings in it. Because we have to ask questions about debt and where that stands in relationship to the functioning of our economies.
Some
But
people make
yeah,
money out of it, don't they?
where is all of that necessary work going to come from if Trump has just dried up all the funding for it? And it's a complicated story, isn't it? Because a lot of the aid that comes from the West is actually only addressing problems that we caused in the first place.
Now
So
there
maybe
is
the
it,
answer
yes.
is to remove the problems that we're causing in the first place. But then you're into difficult territory, which is the political aspect of international intervention abroad by Western countries, is that they're generally protecting their interests.
This is the point, isn't it? It's altruism v enlightened self-interest. And effectively, what we'd be doing is apologizing for vestigial empire all over again, but then taking some practical steps, which is possibly a step too far for the current regime. Well, a dystopian point on which to pause for now, Andy, but thank you very much as ever. Food for thought. Have a wonderful rest of the day.
Cheers, Andy, and
Cheers.
you.
Thanks so much. Bye for now.
Bye.